And let's go ahead and begin things here today by talking about that topic of religious freedom and the fact that it's not just something we should take for granted, but a gift that needs to continually be defended. So we have with us, Gregory, do we have with us on the line, Chris? Okay. Well, we'll work to get a hold of him. And as we do that, I just want to introduce this topic a little bit as we're looking at what we mean by religious freedom. Unfortunately, this has been in the news from a Catholic perspective in negative reasons. But we'll also talk about the positive virtues and the importance of maintaining this wonderful gift that has been enshrined in our country's founding documents. And so we have with us now the Executive Director of the South Dakota Catholic Conference, Chris Motes. Welcome to Real Presence Live.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
We appreciate your time today for this conversation, and as I mentioned, your title is Executive Director of the South Dakota Catholic Conference. So could you just remind our listeners what Catholic conferences do?
Yeah, in most states they serve as the institutional ambassador to the public square on behalf of the bishops of that state. So they represent their state's bishops on matters of law and public policy. And sometimes I like to think of it as the new evangelization at the Capitol, having a representative of the church there to speak for the church on matters that might arise as lawmakers are doing their work.
Another way to think of it maybe is to keep in the forefront of policymakers important principles with regard to the teachings of Jesus, rather than to just think of those things as being compartmentalized just within our homes or within our church communities, things like that.
That's right. The truths are the truths of the faith are compelling and attractive, and they're good for everybody, not just for us.
They benefit everybody, absolutely. Now, from what I understand, you're fairly new to this position. How long have you been the director of the South Dakota Catholic Conference?
So for me, it's 9 months on the job. The South Dakota Catholic Conference is a new conference. We're the 43rd state to have a Catholic conference. There's been a slow, steady trickle ever since the Second Vatican Council. And so it's a new endeavor, which is a lot of fun. This last legislative session in South Dakota, the Catholic Conference was able to cut its teeth, so to speak, on pro-life issues, which are, of course, are very important to the church. The Catholic Conference opposes both abortion and the death penalty through several different bills. In the future, we look forward to really engaging on other issues that are at the heart of our work, including the family and religious freedom.
Great. And can you tell us just briefly what your background is, what area you came from as you began this work?
Sure. I'm trained in the law. I began my post-college professional career in military service, leading young infantrymen in the Marines, then got a law degree from the University of St. Thomas, practiced law in private practice for a number of years, and I'm now really excited to be doing this great work on behalf of the church.
Terrific, and we sure appreciate the work that you're doing. Now, remind our listeners who are not South Dakota residents, the lawmakers in Pierre, do they meet biennially or do they meet every year?
No, they meet every year. It used to be similar to North Dakota where it was every other year. For the last 25 or 30 years, it's been every year. It's a 40-day legislative session, so it's 4 working days a week for about 10 weeks. And like many states, especially Midwestern states, our legislators really, they're truly citizen legislators. So many of them, they have other work, other jobs, you know, they go back to the farm or ranch or back to their business. Some of them are retired and take it on as a service, for the common good in their retirement. But it is an annual session.
And that posture of the citizen legislators, I think that's resembled in many parts of the Upper Plains and in the Midwest as well. So first of all, let's dive into some of these topics with regard to religious liberty. And you used a phrase a moment ago that I think we should clarify, the phrase public square. What do we mean by that when we speak about the public square?
Well, in a certain sense, it's that temporal order. You know, of course, St. Augustine spoke about the city of God and the city of man. The public square, for our purposes, the idea comes from literally the square at the center of town where people would meet and engage in ideas, have meetings and assemblies. But we use it more as just an image to represent that space where we're interacting together on all of those issues of common importance, those issues of some import to our life together. How do we order our lives in society? And of course, politics and government is a part of that, but it's not the entirety of it. We might also think of culture and the arts. We might think of journalism and of higher education as being also important elements of the public square.
I'm glad that you mentioned those last things too, because it's an idea of embracing more rather than less, and integrating our faith into practical ways in our lives. I also wanted to bring up some observances in the church that relates to the call for preservation of religious liberty. And as I was looking on the website of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, they spoke about a Religious Freedom Week, which is going to be coming up later on this month, from June 22nd through the 29th. And June 22nd is the memorial of St. Thomas More, who was a chancellor and advisor to King Henry VIII in England in the 16th century. Can you just tell our listeners what the example of St. Thomas More means to us with regard to defending religious liberty?
Yeah, well, Thomas More is a really powerful example for us. His dying words were, "May I be the king's good servant, but God's first." Mm-hmm. You know, he was a public servant, achieved very high office as the king's chancellor, and the king was trying to force Thomas to compromise his conscience, specifically on what the nature of marriage is. And rather than compromise his conscience, Thomas resigned his office, and then several years later, just through the power of his silence, really, the king sought to compel him to speak through the oath of succession, affirming this flawed view of what marriage is. So, and the lesson we learn from Thomas is that the exercise of our religious freedom, it deepens and purifies our love of country. It's the example also of St. John Fisher, a bishop who was killed also on June 22nd, a couple weeks before Thomas, actually. Testifying on that same example to the state, Bishop Fisher, as he was being led to his execution, he was singing the Te Deum, and he was praying for his king. And it's like, wow, what an example for us that really, when we're truly and fully alive as Catholics, we have hearts that are actually that desire the good of the civil order, that are seeking to tell the truth in the public square.
St. John Fisher, a bishop of Rochester in England and a lifelong academic and administrator at Cambridge, someone who, at least in the part of the clergy, stood tall in opposition to the unjust and tyrannical demands of King Henry VIII and those who were consorting with him. So that's a great foundation for us spiritually when we look at an example of our faith and something that is not too far from removed, you might say, from our experience. Let's talk about our understanding of religious liberty, religious freedom. We speak about it as freedom of religion rather than freedom from, you know, so we're not talking about kind of a license and, you know, anarchy and things, but a positive perspective. Can you speak to that understanding of religious freedom?
Yeah, of course. And here the church's teaching is really helpful for us in understanding it too. There are kind of two levels of it. So the first level, and this is in the church's declaration on religious freedom, the first level is that religious freedom means that all men are to be immune from coercion, such that no one is forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs. So level one is no coercion. We ought not be coerced into adhering to any particular tenet of the creed. Mm-hmm. So The important question, though, the really important question is why? And so church teaching goes on. This freedom from coercion has its foundation in the very dignity of the human person. It exists because we all are bound to seek the truth, especially religious truth. And once we come to know it, we are bound, we're morally bound to conform our lives to it, to order our whole lives in accord with the demands of the truth. So the first level is we ought to be free from coercion so that we can actually pursue the truth and come to embrace it of our own accord. And this, of course, is recognized. Our founding fathers recognized this in, you know, they ratified the Constitution 1789 and quickly realized it's not quite done. So they pass the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, and number one on the list. And I like to say it's number one because it's most important.
Mm-hmm.
First, they say Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And the purpose, sometimes the modern society wants us to think that this means that God doesn't belong in the public square. That's not what it means. It means that the government ought not force us to choose. And we know from the experience of the colonies that they had all fled persecution one degree or another. We have, you know, Quakers and Catholics, Puritans, and Presbyterians. And then the second clause of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Mm-hmm.
So the first level is, okay, no coercion. But then that begs the question, of course, what's next? What then? And we know as Catholics, okay, let's seek the truth and let's conform our lives to it. So it's not just freedom is incomplete if we think about it as the absence of coercion. It's only complete when we think about it in terms of its deeper purpose, which is not just to do what we want, but to do what we ought.
Yes. And let's think about that principle of the genius of our founding fathers when they came up with the language of the First Amendment. It does not require action from citizens. So it's not a burden placed upon us. You must belong to the state religion. You must pay dues. You must sign up or that sort of thing. What it does is it prohibits the government from acting upon citizens in this area. And the genius of this is that climate allows religious activity really to flourish rather than to be something that people are checking off the list because it's mandated somehow by the government.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So now let's talk about some of the main issues that we're running into here. One of the difficulties I think that we've seen in the fight for religious freedom has been labels that opposing groups have been attributing. Like if we are trying to stand up for religious liberty, whether it be the rights of businesses or various things like that, that there will be a designation of that as hate speech or hate groups. What can we do to try to overcome that misconception?
Well, first, we just need to be very, very clear that it's not. We don't have anything to be embarrassed about. We ought not be embarrassed for our beliefs. And there are those out there that would want to make us feel like, oh, we have to be quiet or we have to bite our tongue when we want to tell the truth. And this really just came, it was cast into the public eye lately with the Supreme Court publishing its decision in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case.
Mm-hmm.
Out of Colorado. You know, it's somewhat of a complex legal case, but in a nutshell, a homosexual couple sought to compel a baker, a Christian baker, to bake a cake for their so-called same-sex wedding. And this gentleman, he was polite, and he said, you can buy some cupcakes out of the case, or it's not that I won't serve you, but I won't create something that affirms what I don't believe in. So it's not like they were just trying to buy a dozen cookies off the shelf. It was make us a cake that affirms affirms what we want. And he was penalized by a state commission that really did what you're describing, Father, really described his faith in really derogatory terms, as if it was just a ruse for some animus towards these people. And in fact, there was no animus towards the persons whatsoever. He didn't agree with their actions, which is one way in which we can distinguish ourselves. But it's coming up more and more. We need to be clear that this has got nothing to do with bigotry. This is the age-old teaching that we're adhering to, and it's reasonable.
Mm-hmm. We are visiting with Chris Motes, who is the executive director of the South Dakota Catholic Conference, here on Real Presence Live. SDCatholicConference.org is the website where you can find more information about the activity that they are participating in. I also wanted to just make a mention of something that you cited a moment ago here, Chris, the Vatican II document on religious liberty, which is one of the shorter documents issued from the Council, but really was, I think, revolutionary for a lot of Catholics and Christians around the world in terms of speaking about this value in terms different than what they were used to hearing in their local circumstances.
Right. Yeah, it was a different kind of a new way to speak the truth. And for us as Americans, in a certain sense, it validates our experience. Not that we Americans aren't without flaws, but I think that this was a truth that we grasped. It was self-evident, as our founders put it.
Right.
We grasped it, and it's something that we've been able to witness to the rest of the world, a very healthy truth.
Mm-hmm. Let's follow up on something we were talking about with regard to the positive nature of religious freedom. Sometimes people look at it in almost a relativistic way, you know, as if we were saying, just leave us the heck alone. You know, that's right. The only thing we're thinking about for religious freedom. We're not embracing kind of a relativistic sort of viewpoint when we talk about religious liberty, are we?
No, and it's, you know, for us as Catholics, embracing religious liberty is not the same. It would be false for us to say that all religions are the same. That's not the case, mm-hmm. or that they're all equal. We believe that we are adherents to the true faith, but it's how do we actually engage with other people, and how do we respect the freedom of others to seek the truth. Without coercion, without being forced into it. Of course, if they're forced into it, it's not true. It's not a.
It's a violation of the person, actually.
it's a violation of their dignity. That's right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the face of relativism, first and foremost, we can be confident in the truth. It exists. It's magnetic and attractive. And we find mm-hmm. joy and meaning when we order our lives in accord with it. So I like to just remember St. John Paul II, who reminded us that we always propose it, we never impose it.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do that in both word and deed, in so many different ways in each of our lives.
Yeah, I'm also reminded of something I think is attributed to Archbishop Fulton Sheen, where he said, right is right, even if no one believes that it is right, and wrong is wrong, even if everyone claims that it is right. So it's a matter of having that conviction. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on the issue here of some of the legislation that had been attempted in different places. Back when Mike Pence, vice president, was governor in Indiana, there was a religious freedom bill that caused a lot of consternation and stuff like that. How can we promote the ideals of religious freedom without flying into those sorts of hornet's nests that we've seen in examples like that?
Well, you know, it's the virtue of prudence, which is the virtue that at times guides all others. So it's we just have to prudently discern the. Politics is kind of a constantly shifting sand, but the reality, just to be completely frank about it, Father, is that I think we have to be okay with some of those flashpoints occurring. You know, there's going to be friction, and we know that I mean, our Lord promised this to us, that if we're following him, we would face persecution, and, you know, to be a sign of contradiction, this may occur. So we don't desire it necessarily, mm-hmm. but at the same time, in order to be faithful, we have to understand that it may happen.
Yeah, and that gift of the Holy Spirit of fortitude is essential when it comes to lots of different contexts, so that we have the backbone that we need, and to realize that the love of Christ is urging us on as the scriptures go. Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time today, and blessings to those of you folks at the South Dakota Catholic Conference for the work that you do.
Thank you, Father.
You're very welcome. And also, I wanted to just briefly mention that Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, I believe, is the point man for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops with regard to religious freedom issues. He's a great resource when it comes to understanding where the Church comes from on religious liberty.